very polarizing issue. And to use the New York City metaphor, it's a political third rail. Governor Cuomo will be running for re-election next year. It's widely said that he has presidential ambitions. And as your listeners no doubt know, whatever he decides on the issue of fracking, he'll get a lot of grief for it. The last polling numbers I saw in New York State, it's almost 50-50, evenly divided, for those that are pro-fracking and those that are against fracking. And it's a sort of an impossible political calculation for someone like Cuomo. And, you know, he's essentially put a temporary moratorium on the process while health and environmental studies are being done. And I'm not aware that there's any sort of due date for that, for those studies. And essentially, to use the political parlance, he kicked the can down the road. He's kind of hoping that his personal situation will change by the time he's forced to make some kind of decision on this. I don't know if that's realistic or not, but he's avoiding the issue, and I understand why.
Right. And you mentioned this kind of, I guess, this dichotomy between the electorate, you know, the New York State electorate. And one of the interesting things that's emerged, I think, is the kind of one of the subtexts, I guess, is the sort of downstate upstate dynamic where the opposition to fracking, you know, is kind of primarily coming from, you know, from downstate, you know, the five boroughs, that kind of area. And the support tends to be more in areas like the Southern Tier and so on, where people obviously have significant interests. Is that something that you kind of addressed in your book?
Absolutely. In fact, I begin the book explaining my own situation. In November of 2009, I attended the first and I believe so far the only public hearing in New York City about hydrofracking. And in 2009, people had heard of fracking. It was starting to make a lot of waves, and there was a lot of confusion. And went to this meeting, and there were people from upstate, people from downstate. You know, some people were dressed in camouflage, other people were dressed in suits and ties, and some people were dressed up as mountains and fish. And it was a huge crowd. And I was there because I was reporting on a book about fresh water, which is how I got into this subject originally. And so I was curious to talk with people, but I was also there for a personal reason, which is I am a citizen of New York State, but also a resident of New York City. And so what happens in the New York watershed directly impacts me and, you know, 9 million other city dwellers every day. And so I was very curious about this, and there was a lot of back and forth. There were some people there who I took to be farmers who were sort of defiant about their ability to lease their property to the drillers or to find jobs in the gas fields and to benefit from hydrofracking in the way that people just across the border in Pennsylvania have done.
Yes, and that's often a comparison. Yeah, that's often a kind of an example that's used by, you know, proponents like the Joint Landowners Coalition. They're always saying, you know, we're missing out on this opportunity across the border in Pennsylvania.
Right, right. And I think they see, you know, literally a few miles away, people are benefiting very directly. On the other hand, there were a lot of people at that meeting who were very anti-fracking, and the rhetoric was really getting kind of inflammatory as we went on, and the pro-fracking people were saying the choice was you can either get rich or stay poor, while the opponents were saying things like, well, it's a choice between clean water, you know, or your flaming tap water. And, you know, neither of those statements is really accurate. It's a very complicated issue. And at the end of the night, I think a lot of the crowd was more confused than they were when they came in. This is the problem, that there's a lot of missing information or misinformation, disinformation that's out there. It's a very emotional subject. you know, now you've got the Wall Street Journal saying that that fracking is a matter of economic life or death. And on the other side, you have people like Yoko Ono or the actor Mark Ruffalo who are saying that, you know, if we pollute the New York City watershed, we'll have to build a $10 billion filtration plant and maintain it. And, so the rhetoric has ratcheted up. And, you know, in the years since that meeting, 2009, I think the two sides have gotten only more polarized. So the reason I wrote this book is that I felt that here was an opportune moment to kind of explain what this was all about, because people have heard of fracking and very often don't really understand it. So I wrote this primer on hydrofracking in which I explain, you know, exactly what it is, how it's conducted, where it's done, why it's done. And without taking a side, I say, look, here are the pros to fracking and here are the cons against fracking. And then I end by saying, well, here's the likely future and some of the new innovations that are coming over the horizon, new regulations and so on. Yeah. So I hope that, you know, this is a very important issue. And I encourage a debate, but I think it should be an informed debate. And what disturbs me is that there's a lot of, again, a lot of misinformation on both sides. And, you know, we need to have this conversation, but at the moment, I think it's just a lot of shouting and not people not listening to each other.
And I guess it's also a conversation that continues to sort of transform, you know, almost daily. I mean, a local Western New York county has just this week in the last couple of days banned hydrofracking. There's some new information out about from a set of WikiLeaks about the kind of foundations of the anti-fracking movement in New York State. So it's an ongoing conversation. But maybe we can sort of just pick on a couple of things that I think you sort of settled on in your book as well. One was the role of health studies, and health studies because, as you mentioned in your sort of opening remarks, this kind of waiting period around this critical health study that Cuomo has sort of, you know, continually kind of deferred to as being the sort of informing document that's going to decide whether hydrofracking comes in or not. You say that that the level of health studies that are available out there at the moment are kind of largely anecdotal. What did you mean by that? And what impact do you think that has on the debate?
Well, one of the central problems is that there is a kind of general lack of information. And part of that is that the Environmental Protection Agency is the one that is tasked with overseeing the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. But in the case of hydrofracking, their hands have been tied partly as a result of the 2005 energy bill that was midwifed by Dick Cheney. And in that bill, there's something that's come known as the Halliburton loophole, which allows frackers to not make public all of the chemicals that they use to frack. That's just part of it. But in a larger sense, the EPA has been defunded and marginalized and politicized. And so they haven't done a real big comprehensive study yet. However, they're in the middle of doing just that right now, finally. They've said in the past that fracking is important. They've issued reports on cases in Pennsylvania and Wyoming in which they've said that there's evidence that fracking has led to water and air pollution, and then they seem to have backtracked on those studies. So that's the background. There's a deal of great deal of confusion and uncertainty. I think they're worried about the legal aspects of this and the political aspects. It's a politicized issue. So the lack of health studies has been a problem, and it's just worsened the debate. The moment the EPA is in the middle of its first big national study, and I think that preliminary results are due out next year, and then the final results in 2016, I believe it is. And that will really affect the debate, both sides of the debate.
Because it'll get away from the sort of he said, she said, lack of peer-reviewed
Right.
You know, kind of press release.
In the meantime, there's a lot of academic studies out there, particularly about air pollution, which has become the new focus. Traditionally, people have been worried about water pollution. Now it seems that the methane, which is natural gas, CH4, that gets into the air from a gas well is an extremely potent greenhouse gas, something like 20 times more potent than CO2. That's become the focus of a lot of academic studies. There's been a lot of controversy about some recent studies. One authored by a Cornell professor, Robert Howarth, who said that something like 3.6 to 7.9% of the methane from a fracked well escapes into the atmosphere. So if he's right about that, that means that shale gas is actually dirtier than oil or coal. And that's been the big selling point for fracking up until now, is that, shale gas is a cleaner fuel. On the other hand, his study, Howarth's study, has been heavily criticized, even by one of his Cornell colleagues. There's a relatively new study by the University of Texas that says that methane leakage is much less. It's less than 1%. Now, if that proves true, that's also big news. That study is just the beginning of a larger suite of studies. They're going to do 15 follow-up tests, and environmental groups like the Environmental Defense Fund, but also energy companies are backing that particular study, because if methane leakage really is below 1%, then there's no question that shale gas is cleaner than coal. And even Howarth himself has said that if that's proven true, then he'll be much less worried about fracking. But we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of news and information to come.
Right.
And certainly the health impacts, you know, it's a big deal.
Just moving on to another issue, which I guess, our position up here is sort of looking at the subtext around poverty, and a lot of these sort of affected, if you look at the sort of demographics, you know, the census data on some of the key counties along the southern tier, the border with Pennsylvania, where there's, you know, traditionally very high above average unemployment at the state level. Obviously, there's been big shifts in the agricultural sector, where, you know, dairy farms are less viable than they used to be, and people, you know, signed on to these leases, prior to 2005, 2006, 2007, with very high expectations that they were going to be able to, you know, sort of leverage this lease money to keep their operation going or keep it in the family, that kind of thing. Do you think there's been enough focus really on, the bigger economic, you know, the bigger economic picture around, outside of people's vested interests, just the sort of the broader economic difficulties of affected counties?
Well, it's a good question. It's a really tricky question, too. Personally, I think that the sort of sociological impacts of fracking are really interesting and something that people don't think about too carefully. But you know, just to go to your comments, I mean, one of the things that people don't realize is that, in fact, fracking has been so successful that we're in the middle of a gas glut right now, and gas prices have fallen 60%. Last year, they dipped below $2 per MBTU, which is, a point where the frackers aren't making any money. This year, they doubled. They were up a little over $4 per million BTU, and they're expected to rise a little more next year. But, you know, some of these contracts that the frackers sign require them to keep pumping, whether they're making money or not. And so these little wildcatters who come in and think they're going to get rich overnight are facing a rude awakening. The upside of that is that cheap gas has been great for industry. It's had a huge impact on trucking and steel and even, you know, the making of plastic toys for Christmas. And companies like Dow Chemical that moved their factories abroad decade or so ago, and they're now bringing them back here because the fuel is so cheap. The other sociological thing that people don't often think about is, you know, if you're in a rural town and you're struggling to get by and suddenly the fracking circus shows up, the impact is really severe. You have hundreds of guys, and they're mostly guys, showing up. They're working 24/7. It's very noisy. There's lights. There's fumes. There's pumping. There's trucks running on the roads at all times of day. You can't find a hotel room. You can't get a meal in a restaurant. There's nothing left on the grocery store shelves. If you're a woman in a bar, you get swarmed. And so this goes on for a matter of months. And then suddenly what happens is once the well is fracked and the gas or the oil is flowing, the crew departs. And there's a sort of a skeleton crew that maintains the wells. But the circus leaves town, and there's a huge sort of hangover effect that happens. And I think that that's actually a rich area for study, and it's something that people need to consider. It's almost like a gold rush, it's the old days in San Francisco when all the social ills that were accompanied with the gold rush really had a long-term impact. And so, you have, as you mentioned, the economic impact, but you also have the sociological impact on rural communities, and it's something that definitely deserves broader study.
And speaking of communities too, one of the other things that's come up is this issue of home rule with small counties, sometimes counties, towns making decisions, deciding at the local level that they're going to make a decision around their own local moratorium on fracking activity, perhaps. And that's kind of opened a whole kind of can of worms around, the industry says, well, you can't just have this piecemeal approach because it makes, exploitation completely unviable because, we can't just sort of do leases across county, stop a lease just because the county line runs through it, that kind of thing. And then you've also got people are saying, who are saying this is about community decisions and not just about, things that can be enforced from Albany or from a corporate office in Texas.
Sure. No, I mean, this is fascinating. And I saw this when I was out in Colorado. There's, a number of towns, three or four towns, that have declared that they will not tolerate fracking. And then you have the governor of Colorado, Hickenlooper, saying that won't stand for that. And you have this kind of insurrection happening. And I didn't know that there was a township upstate in New York that had outlawed fracking. This is a really tough decision for communities and also for companies that are trying to be responsible, and they need certainty. This gets at one of the issues that I found striking, which is that there's no one set of national regulations governing fracking. At the moment, it's been left up to each state to decide what to do and how to regulate. So you'll have a state like Pennsylvania, which has been fracked intensively, and slowly but surely they've developed a fairly comprehensive set of fracking regulations. But you have a state like California, in which the frackers have gone in there pretty heavily without anybody in the state legislature really understanding. And they suddenly realized that over 1,000 wells have been fracked, including some offshore, and they were really caught flat-footed. There's hardly any regulation there now, and yet California has a very strong environmental movement, and there's a danger that the pendulum could swing too far the other way, danger from the industry perspective. And they're in the middle of a huge debate in California now about how to strike a careful balance between enough regulation and too much. Wyoming has just issued some strict fracking regulations, but then you have a state like Kansas, which has no regulations whatsoever. So you have this national kind of hodgepodge regulations and oversight, and in a way that works to the advantage of the energy industry because they can work their way around things. But I think that we're going to have to get to a point where we have a national conversation about this. To try to regulate it state by state, let alone town by town, gets very complicated very quickly. It just makes the problem worse.
Just wonder what your thoughts were around how this, what this has done to the issue around renewables, renewables and alternative energy. Obviously, you mentioned the cheap gas prices has really, some commentators have said that's really, for example, hampered incentives for investing in things like, you know, wind or solar, because obviously gas is just so cheap at the moment. What were your thoughts about where the sort of argument, the debate around renewables sort of sits in this conversation?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a central issue here. The Obama administration has essentially sold hydrofracked natural gas, shale gas, on the premise that it is what they call a bridge fuel, which will bridge us from dirty fossil fuels like coal and oil to much cleaner energy supplies like wind, geothermal, hydropower, and solar. And those are called renewable energy sources because they are Earth's most elemental energy. The renewables are kind of the dream, and we do have a lot of the technology that can access that energy, but it really hasn't been scaled up and commercialized yet. And to do so will be quite expensive. We're going to have to reconfigure the grid. We'll have to come up with new ways of powering our cars and our transportation sector. And so the notion of natural gas as a bridge fuel has been very powerful. And yet, as you were just saying, the irony is that fracking has been so successful and gas prices are now so low that they are actually undermining the viability of renewables because renewables are now more expensive than natural gas. And so that's a great danger. And there was a Harvard study about this, and the authors of that study essentially said, we may have to get to a point where we artificially support renewables in order to make it competitive with natural gas. And that will be a whole other sort of political battle. But this is all a sign of the maturing of the hydrofracking as an industry. And people, I think, are generally aware of the dangers of global warming. It's interesting to me that just today, the Obama administration announced that they were going to invest $200 million in investigating new nuclear research, which is something that's been off the table for decades now.
I was going to ask you about that because it's interesting, certainly seeing the way that nuclear's being kind of recast as, as the new green, quote-unquote, energy source.
Yeah, right.
in the rhetoric.
Well, look at France, for example. France has outlawed hydrofracking because of concerns about pollution, particularly to groundwater. And yet the French get something like 70% of their power from nuclear. That seems to be an odd split to me. Nuclear has been considered kind of persona non grata for the last 20 years or so, or 30 years, really. Nuclear plants are very expensive to build and still don't have a very good system for dealing with spent fuel rods. And yet, as you say, now it's being positioned as kind of this new green energy driven by concerns about global warming. And who would have ever predicted that even 5 years ago? It's really astounding to me. Nuclear is going to have the same hurdle to jump that renewables do, which is, can it be done cost-effectively compared to hydrofracked shale gas?
Right.
We'll see.
And it and it's had its fair share of kind of former, you know, former hardcore Greens who are now, you know, apparently converts to you know, to back to the nuclear option.
It's stunning. Yeah, it really is quite amazing.
So just to circle back, because I know water, you know, we talked a bit about water, but I just wanted to talk a little bit more about that before we close up, because water's emerging. You mentioned the Halliburton loophole and the kind of, I guess, of you know, the kind of density of detail that can lie in that sort of information around the sorts of additives. You know, this has been a kind of a sore point for a lot of people who are trying to sort of you know, kind of get some granular detail on the impact of things like, you know, fracking wastewater. There's a whole set of discussions, you know, the Coast Guard's exploring, you know, shipping fracking wastewater by barges. There's all sorts
on
of
the
issues.
Hudson.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
and there's all sorts of issues around exclusion zones. And, you know, just getting back to where we started, which was sort of, you know, speaking from New York, and you have areas like the Delaware River Basin where there's these big exclusion zones because, you know, obviously New York City's watershed needs to be protected from, you know, the slightest potential for contamination from any sort of industrial operation. And yet the local people say, well, you know, this is all just hampering our economic, you know, our economic development opportunities because we're not allowed to sort of develop these areas. So you sort of, you know, there's this kind of rhetorical, I guess, entropic sort of discussion. So I think, so where do you see, do you really see that this EPA study at the kind of a bigger, more definitive EPA study plus the health review that will eventually, you know, come through in New York State, is that going to sort of shift the conversation substantially, or are we going to stay locked into our kind of positions?
Let's say that I'm cautiously optimistic about that. You know, I think this will remain a hot-button, polarizing issue for many years to come. And that's maybe a good thing. You know, I think that rushing into something like this for a short-term gain without thinking through the long-term implications is foolish. And yet I'm also sympathetic to those who feel that they would like to make a living and you know, preserve their farmland and their family business. And so it's really tricky, and that's why I resist the sloganeering on either side of this debate, because I think it actually just worsens things. It's a nuanced issue, and you know, water is you know, the term hydrofracking. You know, water is essential to the process. You have an issue of quantity. You know, it uses each well uses something like 1.5 to 5 million gallons of water every year, which in a place like New York State is not that big of a deal. But if you're in an arid state like Texas or California, or if you're in a nation like China or India or Australia, where there are terrible droughts and water shortages, and where fracking has spread, that takes on a different cast. Then there's issues of water quality, chemicals that are used, the natural radioactive elements that are dragged up by fracking, the potential for groundwater contamination, and as you said, the wastewater disposal. What do you do with this stuff? Once you know, it's not quite as bad as trying to dispose of nuclear fuel rods, but it is it's a major challenge. And I was recently in Arkansas, where they've had terrible earthquakes as a result of injecting wastewater deep underground into fault zones. And the worst one, I think, took place in Oklahoma, where there was a magnitude 5.7 quake that destroyed 14 homes and was felt across 17 states. And you know, that was major. I mean, that kind of thing is very rare, it must be said. Usually these tremors are very slight. But I guess the larger issue is, you know, you're not going to get these huge advantages for free. The advantages you get from gas and oil come at a price, and we as a society have to decide what price we are willing to pay and for how long. I think the trap is that the entropic trap, as you said, is that we we get caught up in the short-term pluses and minuses, and we it's easier to put off the long-term. And so, you know, how do we produce the same amount or more energy in a cleaner and safer way over the long term? That's the real dilemma. And at the moment, I don't think it's realistic to think that fracking is going to go away anytime soon. There's just too much money. There's too much oil and gas. There's too much political clout there. You know, gas does burn cleaner than coal and oil. It could, you know, fracking could provide a long-term supply of relatively clean fuel that will help us transition to these more sustainable sources of energy. But it has to be used responsibly. If gas prices stay super low and we don't replace the dirty fossil fuels and we undermine renewables, then I think shale gas will be considered a failure over the long term. So it's a critical question, and I think, you know, as they say, that with great opportunity comes great responsibility, and we all need to form ourselves and respond accordingly.